Labor and Commerce will now come to order. It's 3:25 p.m. on April 4th. With us, we have Representative Thompson, Sadler, Johnson, Olson, Miller, and Holmes. Representatives. We do have a quorum to conduct business. We also have Senator French in the audience awaiting his bill, which will be coming up shortly. But the first bill on the calendar is House Bill 122. And with us, we have Dana. Senate Bill. My apologies. Dana Owen from Senator Egan's staff. Welcome back, and please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Dana Owen. I'm staff to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, which is the sponsor of Senate Bill 122.
One of my favorite committees, I might add.
Mr. Chairman, I can describe for you either the bill and the progress that it's gone through, or I could take up the bill as it exists, or I could take up the bill that you, the CS that you've shown us previously. Which would you like me to do?
Why don't you take it up as it came to us, and then the CS will do second, but that's only, that should take about 30 seconds.
Sure. Okay. Mr. Chairman, the bill that passed the Senate is essentially does
version 9.
Oh, version 9 we're talking about?
It's the let me see, it would be version I, yes.
Yep.
Backslash
okay.
I.
Version I.
Mr. Chairman, the aim of this bill is really in two parts. One is to ensure, or at least attempt to ensure, that titles which are researched and issued in the state of Alaska do in fact have an Alaskan perspective on it. As you may know, there are many businesses which want to do this work offshore and in other places than Alaska, and they solicit that business regularly. The entitle industry here in Alaska has expressed concerns to us that may result in imperfect titles down the road. This is an attempt to make sure that at least some Alaskans have a look at that title before it's issued. That's the first purpose of the bill. The second purpose of the bill is to eliminate a practice which has been eliminated in, I think, now 40 of the other states, and that is a transfer fee covenant. These covenants allow for the original seller of a piece of property to gain in perpetuity a fee every time the real estate transfers. An interesting note when I was doing some research on this issue is that the first time that this was outlawed was in, I believe, 1857 in the state of New York, when the New York courts ruled it to be a, quote, vestige of feudalism. It has not become an issue or a terrible issue here in the state of Alaska, but we see no reason why it should ever become one, and so the second purpose of the bill is to eliminate that possibility. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to point to the changes that we made in the bill that arrives at the bill that passed the Senate. In Section 1 of the bill, it would be page 1, lines 7 through 9, we made it so that a title insurance has to be written through a title insurance limited producer. As you may hear later in testimony, I know that Director Hall is here, and she can explain this in probably in greater detail than I can. In order to have one of those licenses, you have to have a business here in the state, and my understanding is that business also has to be a business which is open to the public. While that's no guarantee that it will necessarily be an Alaskan running that business, it's probably as close as we can get to ensuring that an Alaskan will have that business. In Section 2 of the bill is a simple statement that the title insurance limited producer may not obtain a license unless the producer is a resident of the state. That bill, or that provision, as many of you probably know, is controversial. You, I believe, in your packets have a memo from the drafter who expresses some doubt over whether or not that would pass constitutional muster. It was our choice to leave it in the bill. And in Section 3, the title transfer fee covenants, we made no change in that. It's just as I described it to you earlier. However, I understand, Mr. Chairman, that the CS that you are going to take up today does have a change to that section. Would you like me to go ahead and describe that?
Why don't you wait till we bring that one up?
Sure. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Who's got a question on version I?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Dana. This may just be me not understanding how this particular sentence is written, but line 8 on page 2 indicates that producer may not obtain a license unless that producer is a resident of the state. That really, just as I read it right there, it doesn't define for me which state. I assume it means the state of Alaska, and is that covered somewhere here? Perhaps line 4 on page 1 takes care of that, but just from my cursory glance, it is the state, but I don't see the word Alaska in here anyplace else.
Mr. Chairman, this is an issue that has never arisen. We just assumed that because it's in the Alaska statutes, it would refer to the state of Alaska. However, we would have no objection to your clarifying that.
Okay.
Do I hear a friendly amendment?
May I just suggest that we indicate the state of Alaska?
Where at?
That would be page 2, line 8, at the end of that sentence, a resident of the state of Alaska.
Mr. Chairman.
So you're asking for friendly amendment number 1?
Conceptual amendment.
May I offer, since I haven't done that before?
It appears to be friendly and conceptual.
Yes.
For discussion purposes.
Yeah, and just for discussion, since it's conceptual, I have no problem with it, just so that the drafters, because I think we do use the word state a lot in our statutes, and it's not generally specified to be state of Alaska, so if we make it conceptual, I don't want us to start doing something that we don't do elsewhere.
Right, and I'm that's why I'm asking. You know, if this is already the convention that's understood in law, then we don't need to make that further clarification, but just for
not,
my
not
first
to muddy the waters, but we have several attorneys in the room, but oftentimes when this is indicated, don't we usually have state capitalized? That becomes the state of Alaska.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not an attorney and I'm not a drafter, but my understanding is that we tend to, in our drafting, minimize the use of capital letters.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman, as long as it's clear from the conceptual amendment that the intention is to make sure that this specifies the state of Alaska, and if no amendment to do so is actually necessary, then that the amendment follow our normal drafting conventions.
Yes. I'd be happy with that.
I'll withdraw my objection.
Is there any further objection to friendly conceptual amendment number 1? Seeing none, we'll see what the drafters say.
I'm satisfied.
Lovely. Any further questions on version 9? Representative Sadler, you got pages of questions.
Which answer my questions, Mr. Chairman?
That's a page.
I said more pages like
those are pages of answers.
Pages of answers.
Okay.
Okay, just we'll ask.
Wait until
my pride has been impugned. To the chair, Mr. Owen, can you just give me a general idea how many people will be aced out of the title insurance business by limiting it to just those that operate in Alaska to meet these definitions? Just who are we excluding and how many of them?
Mr. Chairman, I really don't have an answer to that. I can tell you, however, that we have heard assertions that some people will not be able to go into business. So there may be new businesses who feel they've expressed, let's put it this way, it's been expressed to us by some businesses that there'll be new entrants to the market that will have difficulty doing this. We've tried to craft this amendment so that whatever impediments to market entry are here are minimized. For a little bit of background, there were proposals to, and you'll see in the original bill, there were proposals to extend the period of time in which you had to have a paper title plant, and you had to maintain records for a certain amount of time. That's no longer in the bill that passed the Senate, and remains. We hope in any way that we have eliminated those kinds of impediments to entry. But to give a direct answer to how many, I'm sorry, but I just don't have an answer.
Okay. I think it's mostly aimed at keeping people from outside the.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How many title insurance companies are there in Alaska?
Mr. Chairman, I honestly don't know the answer to that. There are probably 8 or 9. I think Director Hall may have a better answer for that than I do. Well,
she's shaking her head.
She's shaking. She doesn't know.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are we limiting competition? And I know sometimes you don't want that, but it'd be nice to have a monopoly. And if you have 8 people, are 8 companies in the state issuing all the title insurance? Are we going to see the prices start to rise now that there's no competition or no ability to have competition?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, I don't believe that that's going to be the outcome of this legislation. It may have been an outcome in earlier proposals, but we've crafted this, we believe, so that that will not be the case.
I certainly can't speak for the sponsor of the bill, but I think my office has only been contacted by 2 different title companies on this bill. And I'm guessing it's probably real close to the number of people that have contacted you or different title companies.
Mr. Chairman, actually, it's been several more than that.
Oh, okay. Perhaps they're happy with the current version of the the bill.
I would like to think so.
Any further questions? Well, then, in that case, we do have a CS in the packet, version I, believe. I'd certainly entertain a motion to adopt it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move we adopt the CS for Senate Bill 122, version 27-LS789-D as a working document.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. Dana.
Mr. Chairman, the CS that you provided us eliminates the provision that occurs on page 2, lines 15 through 16 of the I version of the bill. That provision reads, payable on a one-time basis only on the next transfer of the interest in the real property. The intent of this was to eliminate any of those title, of those transfer fee covenants, not simply to limit it to one. It's an embarrassment of mine that I looked at that provision several times, thought it meant you get to charge a fee the first time you sell a piece of property. And, of course, it doesn't mean that. It means after you sold the piece of property and collected your fee, you get to take another fee one time the next time it transfers, and that was not our intent. So we're in support of the CS as it's written.
Any questions on version I?
E. The one we just adopted is D.
D. My mistake. Seeing none, I'm going to lift my objection, and we will adopt the version as the working document. And with that, we're going to hold the bill over until Friday. There's a little more work going on, and hopefully everything will be worked out by Friday. Thanks,
Thank
Damon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator French.
Mr. Chairman.
First time you've been here this year, I think. Welcome.
Thanks for the invitation.
Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
My name is Hollis French. I represent West Anchorage in the State Senate.
And what district number or letter was that?
M.
Is it changing?
Undoubtedly.
Not so much.
Yeah,
no,
yes,
I meant, no. Yeah, the letter is changing. I think it might be L, Lima.
Will it be M in the next one?
No, not M. Yeah, pretty sure it's going to be L, but I could
be
wrong.
Mr. Chairman, he will still be my senator.
M for mine.
It's going to be a great. It'll be a great part of town, no matter what, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, welcome back, and you got the floor.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for scheduling this hearing today on SB 104, Mobile Homes as Real Property. The long and the short of it is that this bill is designed to make individuals, Alaskans, who own their mobile homes and who own the land upon which the mobile home sits, able to title their mobile home as real property. That's the long and the short of it. That's the good news. The bad news is that it takes many, many pages to get there because you currently have a series of statutes that treats mobile homes like vehicles. And to get the mobile home out of the DMV world and into the world of titled real estate, it takes some legal doing. And so you've got a lengthy bill here before you that does just that. Let me run through just some of the bullet points of what the bill does. It puts in place a formal method of eliminating the certificate of title to a manufactured home and converting the home to real property when the home is or will be permanently affixed to real property. The bill helps manufactured home owners who own a manufactured home that's on a permanent foundation and own the land beneath it. I guess I'd stop at this point and point out that this is a purely voluntary procedure. No mobile homeowner is going to be forced into this. There's nothing that compels them to do this. The only advantage they will gain from this is that they'll be able to title it as a home, like the home that you perhaps we all live in, and thus gain access to better interest rates on the borrowing and makes it easier to sell. But again, there's absolutely no compulsion here. It's all voluntary. Alaska, unlike the vast majority of other states, has no formal statutory procedure for converting a manufactured home to real property. The bill also brings state definitions of manufactured homes into accordance with HUD definitions for property conversion. The bill is intended to meet eligibility requirements for a bank or other lender to sell a mortgage for a manufactured home to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. And the bill creates a means for titling manufactured homes that has been affixed to real property, but where the original title has been misplaced or lost. The bill has the support of the Alaska Land Title Association, has the support of First American Title, has the support of Wells Fargo, and I think you'll hear from some Wells Fargo folks here in a few minutes. It also has the support of the Alaska Bankers Association, and I think it's worth stopping to take a look at who the members of that banking association are. That banking association is made up of Alaska Pacific Bank, Denali State Bank, First Bank of Ketchikan, First National Bank of Alaska, Key Bank, Mount McKinley Bank, Northrim Bank, and Wells Fargo. The letter from the Alaska Bankers Association is signed by Joe Beadle, and so I think it gives you some comfort that this bill has deep support within the business community from our state of Alaska. I would close by saying that this is not an area in which I am a subject matter expert. We spent a lot of time focusing on the bill when it was in front of my committee, but it also had been through the State Affairs Committee. I think there were over a half a dozen hearings on the bill in the other body. There's no identified opposition, but again, I appreciate your bringing this matter up because it is a lengthy bill that requires some detailed understanding to be comfortable that what we're doing is doesn't advantage one party over another, and that gets the job done. I think you should have available for you three subject matter experts, mainly associated with Wells Fargo, George Ginsburg, their outside counsel, Jeff Harris, a loan administration manager, Patrick Green, regional director for state governmental affairs. I think Shelley Mellett from DMV should be online to answer questions. I'm frankly grateful to the support we've gotten from Wells Fargo. They've contributed numberless hours of their time to helping us and state officials understand this. A former staffer of mine, probably went through, I've got a stack of emails this thick between the conversations he had with DNR with respect to the titling aspects, DMV trying to address their concerns. There were constant sort of little rubs back and forth, and we ironed a lot of them out, but we are in your hands, and we look to your wisdom and guidance with respect to the direction of the bill, and I thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, is there any, what would be the revenue implications to somebody who actually did currently own both their manufactured home, the property on which it sat, and they went through the process of converting to real property? Are there fees associated with that? Would it change their tax consequences? Would there be any change in their mortgage terms?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, as far as the fees, I'm going to leave that to the experts from the state who can answer those questions. With respect to the financial impact of the individual, let's just say, for example, he's got a loan on his or her mobile home that was sort of done at used car rates, for lack of a better phrase. It's titled by DMV. You're probably paying 10% to 12% interest rate on the loan on your mobile home, and by making this eligible for a real estate loan, you could bring that down dramatically. So of course it's going to depend on the size of the loan, but these, you know, some manufactured homes are very nice. You know, you get a double wide, you get a nice extender. It can be, you know, $50,000, $60,000, $100,000 piece of property, and of course sitting on a piece of land that you own. So it's hard to quantify, but I think it's potentially substantial.
Paula? Yes. I've got friends in the real estate business. My family has been involved in that business, and there's always a way to recover costs from any transaction, not unlike law, I guess, but there's points and so forth. If you can't answer, I would like to ask just anybody we get on record about, for the real estate industry, if there would be any associated costs with making that transfer.
Completely fair question, but there's people who are far more qualified than I am to answer.
Yeah, as soon as we get done with the center, we've got at least four people online for questions. You got another one?
Just and maybe the same answer, but a similar question. Would there be any implications for property taxes? I don't know if that would change the assessed value of the entire thing if it was more marketable, if that would raise their property tax liability.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, this is the beauty of the bicameral system. I don't think that question has been raised before, and it's a great question. I'm interested in the answer myself, but I'd be guessing if I answered.
Fair enough. Okay.
Would the property then qualify for the Alaska Housing Energy Program?
Short answer is yes. I believe the answer is yes.
So it'd definitely be an advantage for the having been through the process is long and painful, but it pays off when you finally complete it.
If there's a brief personal anecdote. The first, I lived in Anchorage. I moved to Anchorage in 1978, lived in an apartment house for 6 months, and bought a trailer house over on Piper Street that's now been vacated. But that 12x65 Astro trailer was built in Houston, Texas. And I can promise you it was not set up for Alaskan winters. And I went through the Alaska Weatherization Program on my own with Visqueen and caulking gun. And I wasn't really good at it, but I wound up selling that trailer, and it got dragged down to Girdwoodwell, where I think it still sits. So, and I was attached to that place. It was my first home, and I know Alaskans feel the same way about their homes.
Got a question? Any further questions for the sponsor? Well, online we've got George Ginsburg from, counsel for Wells Fargo for questions. Anybody has any questions for Representative Sadler?
I guess, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Fargo, I missed his name, but Representative Wells Fargo. Thanks. I guess I'd ask you the question that I asked the senator. Would there be any change, likely to be any change in the financing terms for someone who tried to convert or went through converting their vehicle into a real property?
And Mr. Ginsburg, could you state your name and affiliation for the record, please?
Yes, sir. Sure, Mr. Chairman. My name is George Ginsburg. I'm an attorney with the firm of McGlinchey Stafford, and we are outside counsel to Wells Fargo. Representative, when you say a change in the financing terms, can you be more specific, and then I'll answer the question on taxes. I'm just not quite sure what you mean.
Okay, let me scope this. If someone were to convert their property from whatever the category name is for a vehicle titled under DMV into real property, I don't know if there would be any underlying requirement. Well, if in that case, he wouldn't have a home mortgage in the first place, now would he?
Well, currently, part of the problem, as Senator French was referring to, is that you can have a situation where an Alaskan owns a mobile home, doesn't have the certificate of title, and it's already permanently affixed to land. that is the worst-case doomsday scenario here, because legally it may be that it's neither personal property nor real property. And the reason I say that is that at the moment, the Alaska Department will not issue a certificate of title to a manufactured home that's permanently affixed. So a customer has no way to sell the home and no way to finance the home, but yet, legally, it's not clear that it's real property either. He can't sell it as part of the real property, and he can't finance it as a mortgage. So what this bill is trying to do is it's trying to say, look, we need a procedure that will make a manufactured home either fish or fowl. It's either going to be personal property or it's going to be real property, and there is a way, frankly, to do either one of them. Now, it's advantageous, for the most part, we think, for a homeowner whose home is permanently affixed or who wants it permanently affixed to have it treated legally as real property. First of all, as Senator French was saying, if the homeowner wants to finance the home, then if it's real property, first of all, not only is she likely to be able to get a lower interest rate, but in fact, it's not clear that there is a loan market at all to lend just on the manufactured home. It's not so easy to get a loan just on the home at any rate. And certainly, the loan cannot be sold to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac unless there is some kind of clear procedure in the state law to make clear that this is real estate. Now, in terms of what it's likely to cost somebody to do it, number one, there are filing fees. Certain things, applications have to be filed with the department in order to cancel a title or cancel a certificate of origin if there was no title, or in the event that there is neither one of them, apply for what the statute calls a confirmation of conversion. And there are recording fees with the recorder's office. Those are the only fees provided for in the statute. The statute also does not address taxes. There is nothing in the statute about taxes. But what it does say is that once the procedure that's set forth in the statute has been completed, then the manufactured home is real estate for all purposes. So I'm assuming, without knowing much about Alaskan tax law, that it would be considered real estate for tax purposes, and yes, it's not impossible that the property could be reassessed. But as Senator French was saying at the very beginning, and this is the point to be emphasized, this procedure is entirely optional with the homeowner. If she doesn't want to do it for whatever reason, there's no compulsion. Just go on, you know, as she is. But for those who do want it, who want to take advantage of lower rates or an easier way to sell, this provides a way to do it, and it provides, most importantly, a public record so that a lender or a buyer will be able to look in the real estate records and in the records of the department and be able to tell from those records whether we're talking about personal property or real property. So I hope I didn't go on too long, and I hope I answered your question.
No, I actually answered several of them. I appreciate that. So, and the department, maybe the Department of?
Well, basically the Department of Motor Vehicles. I know that's not the proper name of it.
Division of Vehicles. Okay.
Yeah, the Division of Motor Vehicles, because at the moment, unless and until it's converted, it's a vehicle, basically, covered by a certificate of title. The only difference is that it doesn't go anywhere except to be affixed to real estate.
And is it fair to assume that the folks in the municipality that assess real estate, that assess property for real estate tax purposes would be automatically notified of this conversion, that the information would go from, in Alaska, the Division of Motor Vehicles to the Municipal Property Tax Assessment Office? Is that a fair assumption?
Well, the statute doesn't address it. What is put on the real estate records is a recorded affidavit of affixation, which shows that the home has been permanently affixed to real property. Now, frankly, what the communication is between the recorder's office and the tax office, I frankly can't answer. I don't know.
I'm going to assume that the those efficient, busybody people at the assessor's office will find out and will come knock on your door should you convert. Thanks.
I wouldn't doubt it.
Any further questions for Mr. Greenberg?
I'm not sure who.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. And I'm not sure who can answer this, but can someone tell me what permanently affixed is? I mean, if you take your wheels off, you put it up on blocks, is that permanently affixed? Or
no.
What exactly does it take?
Well, let me get it, because the statute does address it. It's not left to interpretation. There is a definition in the statute. Just let me get there.
Good point. Don't let myself.
Okay. Let me see. In fact, if you have the statute, I'll tell you where it is. But manufactured home is permanently affixed when it is, one, anchored to real property by attachment to a permanent foundation, two, constructed in accordance with applicable state and local building codes and manufacturer specifications as provided in HUD regulations, and three, connected to a residential utility, including water, gas, electricity, sewer, or septic service. That's the definition.
And for members of the committee, I think it's on page 20, line 3. Is that right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yes, sir. It is on page 20, line 3 is right.
Actually, this looks like a Linda Hall bill. You're not drafting bills on the side, are you?
Not today.
We do have Shelley Malo online from DMV for any questions.
Yes.
Oh, thanks. Please state your name and affiliation for the record, and I think we've got at least one question for you.
All right. Mr. Chairman, this is Shelley Malo. I'm the Deputy Director for the Division of Motor Vehicles.
Well, I apologize. You got off light.
Oh, no.
No. You did have one.
I did have one, of course. Through the chair, Shelley, any estimation as to how many, first off, how many manufactured homes are titled under DMV laws? And then I'll ask you how many you think would switch over.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we have approximately 8,200 mobile homes registered in our current system.
So, Mr. Chairman, clarification, 80 to 100 or 8,200?
No, 8,200.
Okay. Mm-hmm. It's a difference.
And if you, any estimation, how many that would leave your ranks and go to convert to real property?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, no, I have no estimation.
Okay. Representative Thompson.
Yes, those 8,200, that is how many titles you have? Is that what you're saying?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson. Yes, currently the DMV has 8,287, actually, exactly, mobile homes titled in the DMV system.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler. And Shelley, through the chair, Shelley, do you know how many of those are, I'm going to try and divide this, are permanently affixed or not? I don't know if you track that. Is that information you capture?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we do not capture that information.
Okay. Thank you very much. Jeff Harris, Wells Fargo. Any questions for Jeff? Seeing none. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify on this bill? And nobody else online? Now, with that, we'll close out public testimony and bring it back to the committee for discussion.
Housing discussion.
One comment.
There has to be some.
21 pages to get this done. My gosh.
That's very crazy. Mr. Chairman,
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I haven't had a whole lot of comments come through my office on this, but the very few that I have been positive. They've been from people who own mobile homes, in particularly this situation, who would like to sell them and at this point can't. So I've heard nothing but good things and appreciate the bill coming forward.
I might add, to the best of my knowledge, I don't believe my office has had any negative comments on it.
Zero.
What are the wishes of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I would move the CS for Senate Bill number 104 out of the Judiciary with the individual recommendations. Judish out of Labor and Commerce with individual recommendations and attached physical notes, if any.
Seeing no opposition, the bill will move out of committee. Thanks again, Senator Hollis.
Members of the committee, thank
Hollis
you for
Frank.
Your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to take a brief at ease. Call down again. We're texting.
Conrad, it's sloppy work.
Yeah, the next item on the agenda, obviously, is bill number
326.
And we have Representative Guttenberg and staff with him. Who's doing the heavy lifting?
Oh, well, I've got the muscle with me, but I'll start.
Mm-hmm. Please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Representative David Guttenberg, District 8, west side of Fairbanks, all the way down to Cantwell.
Currently, right?
Currently, no coastal communities in my district. Members of the committee, I sat on this committee for 4 years, and I never thought I would be carrying an insurance bill because there was always so much to be done with insurance. But the guru of insurance is in the back to fill us in. But when a constituent contacted my office and informed me that there was no child-only health care, you know, like many of us, when some people bring it forward, you roll your eyes and say, well, there's got to be something somewhere. And there isn't. So currently, if you have a healthy child, is not eligible for Denali Kid Care, doesn't have a condition that would put him into another high-risk pool, nobody in the state offers health care for that child. If you're grandparents and you get custody of a child or a custodialship and you can't put your child on a health health care, there's no place to go. So the child is left without health care, putting the child and the family at risk. And that's the simple gist of it, of what this bill does. It asks the insurance industry to offer, for whatever the market says it what it costs, a child-only health care plan. So it's as if in the market you could not buy insurance or a pickup. This is making sure that every component of our society is available to have something. And for me, it's amazing that there is no child-only health care. And currently, there's a termination date at the end of the bill, because if health care continues forward the way it rolls out in 2014, that will be offered regardless. But right now, for the next 2 years, there is nothing.
That it?
That's it. In a nutshell, it just says, it just tells the for the people that carry insurance to offer child-only health care.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think it's a good concept, and I like it. Some questions about what other states do, but my question is, are you sure you want to do it in 14 in light of what the Supreme Court's doing?
If it's the committee's wish to take it out, that's fine with me as well.
Mr. Chairman, I think if it's a good idea, it's worth doing, and I getting the vibes that there may be substantial changes in what we think is coming down the pipe. And if this is a good idea, I don't think we want to revisit it in 2 years. I have no problem with extending it, but once again, we have to decide if it's a good idea.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Guttenberg, can you give us an estimation of how big the donut hole, but what's the universe of children whose families are too rich to qualify for Denali Kid Care or are not of means enough to afford private insurance? What's the universe of folks we're...
I'm on Medicare.
One out of six so far.
That's a skewed sample here, though.
What is the number? The AARP has a number of grandparents. I think it's 11,000.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Who have custody?
11,000 children who are in custody.
11,000 families. 11,000 something families that have custody of their children.
And children are defined as being under 18 or under 26. Right?
18.
Okay. Oh, if I could, there's other legislation in play in this building that would. Require insurance coverage of certain folks, and there's been some good analysis and estimation done of the cost. Have you any estimation of what policies for children only as described in your bill would cost the purchaser?
I don't. I'm sorry. The actuaries will come up with that in the insurance companies. We're not asking for a discount or a waiver on anything. They will market it as if it was just a normal product in their inventory of policies.
But they would probably, they'd be policies purchased by an adult for a child?
Yes.
Okay.
Any further questions?
I think we do have some people online who are...
Oh, I know. We're going to ask Ms. Hall to come up first.
Thank you very much.
She's going to learn one of these days.
Not to come. Yeah, then we're really going to have some problems.
Thank you.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance.
I've got the first question since
it looks like it's questions only.
Well, I don't have anything that I particularly want to say, but...
What is the possibility of access to a CHIA? Is that a viable option since we do have a insurance company in place, high risk?
Mr. Chairman, the healthy children would not be eligible for a CHIA because a CHIA is set up only for people, whatever age, who have conditions that make them uninsurable in the traditional marketplace.
Is there a possibility that this could be done on an administrative basis?
Mr. Chairman, no. We have explored that, and Representative Guttenberg had explored that with us, and that we do not have any statutory authority to allow us to do regulations requiring. Some states have been able to do that.
So you don't have the ability to roll out new products?
No, sir.
I always thought you had that power, but Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman. Is this a unique problem to Alaska? Are other states experience this, or have they fixed it in similar manners?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, the last count that I knew, there were 17 states in the same condition. We had some states who, as I said, were able to administratively require an open enrollment period. They differ from 30 days to, there's at least two states, I think, that have two separate 30-day periods. There are some that are a little bit longer. The open enrollment period in this bill is longer than most of the ones I've seen, but there are 17 states that with the under the federal health care reform in September of, I'm going to say 2010, there were part of the provisions of that health care reform went into effect. And one of those was the underwriting of children under 19. And with the, what was really, excuse me, amounted to, sorry. I am sucking on a cough drop already, but the children that became guaranteed issue, there was no underwriting.
We have anything else for Linda?
Since you already had a cough drop, I got one. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm already chewing a cough drop. I'm sorry. I've totally lost where I was. With that provision and the prohibition of any underwriting that would have amounted to the same thing as the guarantee issue that would go into place January 1 of 2014, and many insurers decided they did not want to take the risk of having what I would call adverse selection, where you only buy insurance when you really need it. Most insurance is based on a theory of large numbers and large numbers of people contributing and not all of them actually using those funds. And one of the problems we see with the high-risk pool, for example, that is subsidized. While the premiums are high, and many people tell us they're unaffordable, which is probably true for many people, we have to subsidize that. Right now it's about $5 million a year. So taking risks without being able to underwrite was a bigger, I guess I would say, risk of using the resources than they were willing to take. So many insurers, we've had two insurers pull out of the individual market totally in our state, but around the country this is not an unusual circumstance. It's a long answer to your question.
Paul? Thank you. If we, for lack of a better term, I want to mandate this, are we likely to see other insurance companies pull out for that same reason?
Through the chair, Representative Johnson, I can't answer that. I have not heard any say that, but I'm not sure they would say it to me anyway. Right. So I don't know that. I have had some indication, and I hate to indulge in speculation, but that if there were a level playing field, maybe it wouldn't be as onerous as it might appear on the surface. If everybody has to do it, it's usually not as difficult as, you know, one company offering a coverage, and they get all the unhealthy kids, for, you know, not a very tactful way of putting it, but that's kind of what it could boil down to. So if they all have to, you know, insure the children that come to them without underwriting, it might not be quite as onerous as it sounds.
Further questions for Ms. Hall? She's got her voice back.
I'd like to get back to Brunswick.
Representative Sadler.
Through the chair, Director Hall. Nationally, is this some reference to the what's going to happen to the health insurance industry with the arrival of healthcare mandates nationally, if that should happen? My question is, nationally, does the shadow of this healthcare mandate darken the prospects for any change in health insurance? I mean, is there a chilling effect just in your knowledge of the national insurance market to any changes in healthcare insurance as we wait for the decisions of the Supreme Court and the imposition of the Affordable Health Care Act provisions?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I don't know the answer to that, really. I think the whole health insurance environment today is somewhat, it's certainly under some stress of the unknown. We have, I would say, almost weekly receive new regulations from HHS or CMS, and how we are to now interpret certain pieces of that legislation. And frankly, we may get some 3 months from now that go farther, maybe make more changes, make more demands. So I think there's a tremendous amount of unknown obligations that are probably as chilling as anything. And certainly today, as has already been referenced here, you know, we have a pending Supreme Court decision, but the enactment of pieces of that bill continues.
Would it be at all, is there sufficient data extant in Alaska or in similar states that could allow us to estimate what the cost for a child-only insurance coverage might be?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, no. We now, effective January 1, do have rate approval or disapproval, whichever way you want to look at the glasses half full or half empty. But those rates would have to be filed with us and justified actuarially. And so I don't, even today, we couldn't tell you up front what something is likely to cost because it changes. I can tell you that healthcare in Alaska, as you probably all already know, is extremely expensive. And consequently, health insurance rates in Alaska are considerably higher than most places. So I would not expect child-only coverage to be inexpensive.
One more? Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Linda, and thank you, Representative Guttenberg. I'm not sure who might be able to answer this question, so it's a general one. As I'm reading through some of the provisions page 2, we begin to try and define the late enrollee, and each of the bullets that I see, A, B, C, and E, all lead me to believe that at one time in this child's life through these particular definitions, that indicates that the child lost coverage, that they stopped contributing, or they were covered, or they are no longer eligible. So my question is, if you came upon custody of a child who had never been covered with insurance, it almost seems to me like they've been excluded, at least in this language. Am I seeing that incorrectly? In each instance, it looks like the kid was covered at one point or another, and I know that usually is a mitigating factor in what kind of fees are collected by an insurance company as to whether you have ever had, if you have now, or what happens. If there's a lapse, there seems to be an increase, and as I read through that section, I don't see anything that says a child who's never been covered or hasn't been covered for a long time may or may not be covered by this.
Through the chair, Representative Miller, I would agree with you. I don't think that's there. I think the late enrollee is to allow people to enroll outside of the open enrollment period, which is defined in number 2 on that page. Mm-hmm. But I would agree with you. It doesn't appear to allow a child who's never been covered. And I would put on the table just for your consideration in that if you have a circumstance in which the child has never been covered, we might, I guess I would say, risk some adverse selection. If I have a child who's never been covered, I believe I had a conversation yesterday with Representative Guttenberg, and we talked about the invincible 20-somethings who are sure they don't need insurance because nothing will happen to them.
Of course not.
And as a parent, I have a child that I really think, you know, is a healthy child, doesn't need insurance until maybe diagnosed with something and goes out and buys insurance. That is a kind of worst-case scenario in the health insurance world. And that's the purpose kind of an open enrollment period, is that, okay, if you want coverage for a healthy child, this is when you can get it. And that adding that as one of these exceptions to the late enrollment would kind of make it an open, a pretty open-ended ability to enroll.
I think I understood that. So if you could, from what you just said, if you'll indulge me, Mr. Chairman, sir. So I've got a child who's never been covered with the language I see here. If I take that child to and apply for insurance, would the insurance company have a leg to say, well, this kid didn't lose his dependent coverage, he didn't stop being covered, he wasn't covered because somebody died, or he's no longer eligible. He's never been covered, so he's not in this bill. I don't have to offer coverage for that child.
Through the chair, Representative Miller, he would be eligible for coverage under number 2 between January 1 and March 31. That's really the point of the open enrollment period, to kind of help put some parameters on when you can go out and buy insurance. And Chair Olson, could I give an example of that that may be better than me?
That would be helpful.
I sat through, I don't know if you're familiar with the CHIA, the high-risk pool.
A little.
It's where people who have serious health conditions are able to purchase insurance. It's been a wonderful service to Alaskans. But they have a public meeting once a year, and I always attend the public meeting. And I listened to an individual testify in the public portion of this meeting, probably in June of last year, somewhere in that time frame. And she was there talking about and mentioned the fact that the premiums for insurance in this high-risk pool, as you might imagine, are not inexpensive. There are some statutory constraints on them, but they're still fairly expensive. She spoke to the committee, and I thought it took a lot of courage to do this. She purchased insurance through CHIA in December of the previous year, had a full hip replacement, about $100,000 surgery, in January, and she dropped her coverage in February. That is an example of adverse selection. So she paid 2 months premium, maybe a couple thousand dollars, probably maybe a little more, received $100,000 surgery, but she said she really could not afford to pay those premiums every month, but she really needed the surgery. That's what the open enrollment period is trying to balance, so you can get coverage, but you need to do it while you're healthy during this period of time. Mm-hmm. Does that help?
It does.
Okay.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thanks again, Ms. Hall.
Thank you.
Do we have anybody? I think at this point in time, we'll open it up to the public. Is there anybody in the room that would care to testify? Come on up, Marie.
Welcome back.
I did sign up.
You sure did. You signed up before Linda. My apologies. I'm just so used to seeing you at every meeting.
For the record, my name is Marie Darlin, representing AARP. And I just want to say that, you know, there's no sense in repeating everything you've already heard. So you know why this is needed, why it's important. And I think we can just add a few points out of our letter of support for this, in which we just, again, say that currently there are no insurance companies in Alaska that offer insurance for children only. And unfortunately, AARP, as a group, we have many grandparents, including some who are on Medicare, some who are not, who are raising their grandchildren. And some of the statistics that we have heard say that there are at least 5,000 grandparents in the state of Alaska who are raising somewhere around 8,000 or more grandchildren for one reason or another. And we know that Medicare, people who are on Medicare, it's not something that they can then cover grandchildren under, because Medicare is only for the individuals. It is not for dependents or anything like that. So when grandparents take on this responsibility, the health care is going to be an issue. And I'm sure that most of them realize that if they're going to be able to procure health care for their grandchildren, it's not going to be cheap. And so they have to work that out also. But we want to quote, too, that the 2010 census and the Department of Labor, who has done a lot of work on this, estimate that there are 11,778 grandchildren under the age of 18 in a household led by a grandparent. So that shows you there are a lot of grandchildren being raised by grandparents who the opportunity to buy health care for that child may be something they really do desire to do if they can afford it. And so obviously we are in support of the bill. Anything that will provide one more way for grandparents to take care of grandchildren, it's important. And with that, we just want to say we support the bill. Thank you.
Questions? Thanks again for not only coming to this meeting, but coming to most of them. It's always nice seeing a friendly face in the in the crowd.
Thank you.
And see nobody else signed up in the room. Is there anybody in the room that would care to weigh in? Seeing none, we'll go out to the public, and I'm only showing one person. Is that correct? Adam Wool, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you for joining us today, and please state your name and affiliation for the record, and you've got our undivided attention.
Oh, great. My name is Adam Wool. I live at 446 Henderson Road in Fairbanks. My affiliation, I guess I'm just representing myself and my family right here.
That'll work. Now, please continue.
I will continue. I'm a parent and of two children. Both my wife and I buy insurance through Achia. We both have pre-existing conditions. Neither of us are seriously ill at all, but we are, by law, we won't be covered by any other insurance company, so we buy Achia. Our first child was born about 5 or 6 years ago, and she was able to buy insurance on her own policy in-state through Blue Cross Blue Shield. She has her own policy. Our second child was born almost 2 years ago, and the law has changed, or insurance policy has changed since then. So she is not able to buy insurance. We've tried every company offering insurance in Alaska, and we weren't able to. We tried Achia. We were not able to get it through them. Basically she's in this black hole of not being able to buy insurance. And so it puts us, we'd like to buy insurance for both of our children, but right now there's no way to do that.
Well, hopefully we can, one way or another, hopefully sooner than later, we can have some kind of remedy to that. Any questions for Mr. Wall? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wall, you said you went to buy insurance for your second child, your daughter, your younger daughter. You were told that you could not buy it through Achia, is that correct, or who told you that?
Correct. We spoke to Achia many times, and they said she had to have a pre-existing medical condition, and she is perfectly healthy, so they will not sell her insurance, and all the other insurance companies won't either. And I think it has to do with the beginning of the enactment of the Affordable Care Act, which they've started implementing as far as not being able to reject children from policies, I guess family policies. Anyhow, so they reject all children on a child-only policy.
Follow up?
And forgive me for asking, but for you and your wife and your older daughter, Anchia, is there any cost to your family for that?
Yes. We have three individual plans. Our oldest daughter is with Blue Cross, and she has her own individual plan with a $5,000 deductible. My wife and I each have individual plans with Achia, each with a $5,000 deductible. So we're at $15,000 deductible for three of us in the family. And the youngest child, we weren't able to buy insurance for. And I spoke with a CHIA representative several times, and they told me that in other states, which it's not called a CHIA, but the insurance company that underwrites for a CHIA, they operate in Washington and other states. And in those states, they allow a family plan so that children, healthy children of parents on a CHIA can be incorporated into their plan. But in Alaska, they're not able to do that, or not required to do that.
Okay. So you have the $5,000 deductible, and do you pay any premium costs?
Oh, yes. My wife and I are probably $1,400 combined, and our oldest daughter on Blue Cross is about, I think, $200 a month.
Okay, great.
So that, and you guys are asking questions earlier in your meeting about how much this would cost. We have a healthy child who is on a child-only policy who got in before they changed their rules, and she's paying approximately $200 a month for her coverage.
Thank you, Mr. Wall.
Any further questions for Mr. Wall? Seeing that, I'm going to hold the public testimony open, and it's my intention to get respectfully some help out of Ms. Hall on the names of probably the top 3 to 5 medical plans in the state, and see if we can get them online at Friday's meeting so we can find out what the industry perspective is. You know, I don't believe it would be proper for me to move the bill without, especially one of this significance, without having a broader picture of what the problem is. There may be something related to what's going on in D.C. that is a snag. I think that might be partially the case, but I don't think it's the full case. But with that, we will adjourn until Friday. It's now 4:30.